Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey, the bad movie critic, Knockreiner.
Corey, the bad movie critic. Let me guess, you really liked the M. Night Shyamalan Airbender movie.
There's an Airbender movie? I did recently watch an M. Night Shyamalan TV show that was on Apple TV, I think, of all things, that wasn't horrible.
Oh, wow, that is a great review, Mr. Movie Critic.
Hey.
Anyways... On today's episode, we are not going to be reviewing movies. Instead, we'll cover the latest news stories, ranging from a chief security officer being charged by the U.S. Department of Justice for covering up a breach, a stock exchange being taken down by a denial of service attack, and then some interesting new methods for delivering malware through email.
Wow, that sounds really new and interesting. I never knew malware could be delivered through email.
Listen here, Smarty. So first up on the docket this week, last week, the U.S. Department of Justice charged Uber's former chief security officer, Joseph Sullivan, with obstruction of justice for trying to cover up the company's 2016 data breach. So backing up a bit, back in November of 2016, two threat actors obtained credentials for Uber's Uber developer's GitHub account and then used that to gain access to AWS access keys, which then allowed them to basically have full free reign over Uber's AWS databases and dump all the data. The threat actors managed to steal the personal information of 57 million customers and employees, including 600,000 driver's license numbers from Uber drivers. The threat actors then contacted Sullivan, this is still back in 2016, informed them that they had found a, quote, major vulnerability, and they were able to dump the user database. And in the end, Uber ended up paying the threat actors $100,000 in Bitcoin as a bug bounty, quote unquote, and made them sign an NDA stating, you promise that you did not take or store any data during your thorough research and that you have delivered to us and you also any forensic whatever. Basically, they're saying they didn't steal or keep any data. The threat actors originally signed the NDA using pseudonyms, but in January of 2017, so after the making payments, Uber was actually able to identify them, and they sent legal teams to their houses in a hotel room nearby one of them. One was in, like, Florida, I think. One was in Canada. And they got them to sign new NDA agreements with their real names this time. So this is all an issue because at the time, Uber didn't disclose the data breach until a year later in November of 2017, in which time they also fired Sullivan. The threat actors were also eventually arrested, and just last year they pled guilty to hacking and extorting both Uber and LinkedIn. So, like, a lot of background on this, like, pretty big breach, 57 million customers, and basically the CSO at the time tried to cover it up as a bug bounty instead of an actual data breach. And these cyber criminals basically extorted them out of $100,000 to try and keep quiet.
Yeah. Huge story even back in the time, by the way. I feel like we've talked about this before on the 443.
We did.
But I also know that back in 2015, at least, in May, there's a Daily Security Bite where I cover this hack based on what we knew back then.
Yeah, so the breach actually occurred 10 days after Sullivan gave testimony to the FTC, who was at the time investigating the company for a different breach back in 2014. And funny enough, in his testimony, he basically highlighted the importance of key management and not hard coding access credentials into the source code, only to 10 days later be breached for the exact same thing.
Yeah. And even after, by the way, there seems like there's internal notes from other folks mentioning the lack of key management going on and wondering if it should change. So
yeah, the DOJ got access to a bunch of internal documents in their investigation where there was communications between, like, engineers and the CSO basically saying, we haven't rotated these keys since 2013 and the people who did it are gone now. There was some communication between the CSO and the CEO. I guess they were the only two executives that knew about this breach at the time. One of them said, we need to get certainty of what the cyber criminals have, sensitivity exposure of it, and confidence that we can truly treat this as a bug bounty situation. Uber also ended up paying $148 million as part of a settlement when all 50 attorneys general of the United States sued them for basically breaking every single state's breach disclosure law. That's kind of nuts. You don't often see every single state agreeing that something's going on. Now, I wanted to, like, the story is interesting because it's an executive that is now basically on trial for a breach. And
I think there's
basically lying about the breach or covering it up.
Yeah, there's a difference there, and we should dive into that. Because I don't think it's on trial and potentially jailed for a breach. I think it's for the cover-up. And while I do think executives should be liable to their customers for breaches and maybe should lose their job, I'm not sure if they should be legally liable for breaches. But the cover-up, to me, is the bigger story here. I mean, we've had many talks on the 443 where every company is going to have a security vulnerability, you know, or a breach incident. But in the case of a vendor that has software, I don't think anyone's ever going to be perfect. It's not a matter of when you find some flaw in your software and or your infrastructure that you've set up. It's not about if, it's about when. And while there's nuance here, like there's some mistakes that are just so bad, you can't help but judging the company for not caring enough about security. In a lot of the cases, you know, the mistakes are mistakes. It's unfortunate they happened, but people make them. And I think we both have agreed that it's not so much about whether or not a company has a breach, it's how they deal with it and what they do to rectify it. And this was a big one. And you might argue, you know, you and I could probably argue that this was something that was known internally based on those engineering notes. And maybe it was among the badder examples, or the worse examples, I should say. I shouldn't speak improperly.
Badder. Yeah, you have the best words.
I know. I like to emulate our leaders. but while it might be one of the worst examples of a little bit of negligence, at least, that to me is not the big deal. It's the lack of transparency, the cover-up, and I think that is criminally a bad thing to do personally. And I think we should be very clear that I believe in this sort of cover-up being criminally prosecuted. I don't believe that an executive should be criminally prosecuted for breaches. Unless there's
speaking
some,
as an executive,
yeah, obviously I have skin in the game, but I think even as a non-executive, I don't think executives should take accountability, and that's why getting fired, stepping down, resigning, taking accountability for it, yes, but it's not like a one-person mistake in all cases, and when the government isn't really giving, like if you look at any regulation, I forget what it was, but you were recently looking at a regulation of some sort and you mentioned how generic it was, but PCI is the same way, HIPAA is the same way. Other than maybe encryption algorithms to use, a lot of their advice is you need to do the best practices for security, but we're not going to outline all of those best practices for you. So if the government isn't regulating exactly what you have to do to secure your organization, it can't really hold someone liable for making those type of mistakes, at least as a criminal thing.
In my opinion. I'm with you on that.
I do think you can hold the company liable for, they should have known better, it's the data, they took stewardship of it. But if there's no government regulation on what to do properly, there can't really be a criminal liability for not doing something that no one told you to do in the first place.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like, I know some states and even countries are considering laws that would prosecute executives for breaches, but I think that is going too far unless you're going to have not just standards, but good standards that they have to uphold. And if they go awry of them, that's when they get prosecuted. But like, that does kind of beg the question of, should some organizations that are storing certain types of data be bound by government-created regulations? Like, for example, like Equifax breach, for example, that was almost nearly every single U.S. adult was affected by that, like a large portion of them. And the data they're storing is very sensitive to the point where it could, like, maybe not ruin their lives, but at least make it a lot more difficult in terms of identity theft. Like, should companies that are storing data that is that powerful be bound by regulations and then be held accountable if they fail to properly secure it.
So I believe absolutely on the regulation that if you're doing certain data, there should be regulations. The nuance is what that regulation is, how prescriptive it is in the security, and what the penalty is. Should the penalty be criminal? For some data, maybe you can argue that, but I actually think that the criminal mistakes happen. To get criminal, like, I believe you have to have intention to do it, not just accidental misconfiguration. Now, there's levels of negligence. Like, there might be an accidental thing that could be considered negligence, and there could just be gross negligence. But anyways, I do think we need the regulation around the data. But until the regulations often aren't prescriptive to the methods for protecting. So it's hard to criminalize not having certain methods or another. So it's a nuanced subject. I do think government should regulate this, and companies to some level. I hope tech experts are involved, because sometimes, regulation isn't good or necessarily good or bad. There's a lot of people that are anti-regulation, since they complain about like over-regulation and too much regulation or badly done regulation slowing down business. And there's probably truth to that. And yet there's obviously bad actors that have been proven in some businesses that are intentionally doing negligent or criminal things, which is why regulation needs to exist. So I think we agree for some data, there needs to be a stronger regulation. I think it's very difficult to do that properly without involving the tech experts. And I'm not so sure if the punishment should always be executives being criminally put in jail versus fines to the business that cost a lot of money, and let the businesses handle whether or not they get rid of the executives. Now, that's all totally different than this, which is actually like conspiracy and fraud. I mean, we do have data breach disclosure acts. We already have laws on the records that you have to expose data breaches. And to me, if all this evidence is true, it's a clear case of them not disclosing a data breach and specifically trying to cover it up. And that is very much, in my opinion, a criminal act.
Yeah, and you can't even argue in this case, at least in my opinion, that they were ignorant of the laws, because they were literally in the middle of an FTC investigation for another breach, and he had testified 10 days earlier.
Yeah.
It's pretty
damn. It seems pretty intentional, all the documentation they have. They knew what they were doing. My question, though, is how far past the CSO does it go? On one hand, there's a lot of documentation showing that they were trying to keep it secret within Uber itself, too. And there was a change of CEO during all of this. Like, I think you mentioned that at least the CEO knew, but I believe that might have been, I need to look at the article to check timing again, but there was a change of CEO, and one CEO that argued that the CSO also altered internal documents so that he had no way of knowing a little later. That's...
Yeah, from my understanding of the documents that they produced in court, it was basically the CSO, so this gentleman, Sullivan's decision to classify it as a bug bounty and try and cover it. The original or the CEO at the time was at least aware of it. The new CEO that got brought in kind of during all of this, Sullivan, altered documents to cover up a lot of the facts about this particular incident. But it did seem to be their decision, and it sounds like the Department of Justice has internal documentation to back that up.
Yeah.
So,
but my question still is, they may not have the evidence, but I find it hard to believe that only the CSO knew. There were other folks, and while it was the CSO's decision, I wonder if there's any potential for accessories here, or if we'll ever know. That said, the CSO was making a point of not sharing it very far in Uber itself.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess long story short of this is, if you suffer a data breach in the United States, do not try and cover it up, because you will get sued by every single state and the District of Columbia, and you'll probably lose.
And by the way, let's forget regulation. I mean, if you have a security incident, whether you're a vendor like us, I mean, we could too. And we're a security company, so we're a big target. Or you're just an organization that loses customer data. I feel like history proves that transparency does better for you in the long run. People who fess up to things, people that apologize, let's say they made a mistake, that do everything they can to rectify that mistake, humanity you know, we realize everyone's human, I think. I mean, maybe I'm being idealistic, but if we see sincere apologies and attempts to change, we give people the benefit of the doubt. And a business is not a person, but I think businesses acting with that sort of transparency are appreciated. So forget regulation, forget about the legal penalties and the financial penalties you'll probably have to pay, because there still will be fines potentially depending on what happened. But your best way to recover, in my opinion, is actually through transparency. I think you'll win back more customers, and you'll win back, you know, more just popularity. Who knows? You may even build customers by showing what a upfront company you are.
A great example of this is honestly like LastPass as a password manager. They have suffered a few breaches. Like, the attackers have managed to compromise different systems in a company that is responsible for safeguarding all of your passwords. And even then, because of their responses being quick and thorough and transparent, they're still one of, if not the top rated password manager out there. Like, as long as you weren't grossly over negligent with exact, I mean, even in that case, you should still come clean.
I think you should. I think you're exactly right. I think you will maybe be judged slightly harshly, because there's a difference between gross negligence and some, but I still think the minimizing it still involves transparency and even apologizing sincerely for getting something wrong. I think this idea of not apologizing, not, you know, I know lawyers are involved and sometimes you're worried about that, but I just think in the long run it will help you. That said, there are definitely bad actors out there that just don't care and want to cover it up. And for that, I think we both agree there needs to exist some regulation.
Yep, I agree. Maybe we'll get something out of this incident now that it's slowly starting to wrap up. So moving on, as of this recording, the New Zealand Stock Exchange has been taken offline for the past three straight days in a row thanks to a cyber attack. So in a statement on their website, when it came back up, they stated that they were experiencing a volumetric distributed denial of service attack from an offshore location via their network service provider, and that the systems impacted included the NZX website and the markets announcement platform. And because of that, they decided to halt trading in their cash markets. So it sounds like it wasn't like hacking the stock exchange itself, but because they took off like information, the critical information sources for the stock exchange, they decided to voluntarily halt trading because, I mean, I guess that probably put some people at an unfair advantage.
Well, not only that, if you look at stock markets, they're not really based on anything but expectation. And if there's no information popping up, your fears change and you start to speculate, and markets can go up and down just based on this unfounded fear because of lack of information. So I get why they would close the market, even though what's being DDoSed isn't exactly the market itself.
So interestingly, though, last November, the New Zealand CERT issued a warning about emails being sent to companies in the financial sector that claimed to be from the Russian threat actors Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear, and demanded a ransom in order to avoid a denial of service attack. Now, these emails, they had some examples. They literally said, we are the Fancy Bear and we have chosen company name as a target for next denial of service attack, which there's no way in heck that these are the actual Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear threat actors, because I don't think they've ever resorted to just a distributed denial of service attack to extract ransom.
Well, the other reason is they're like a nation state actor. They're not the type of actor that's going to say, hi, here's who I am. I mean, whoever's claiming,
give me money or I'm going to.
It seems very...
Give me money or I'm going to do a script kiddie attack.
Yeah, it seems like a very false flag attack. By just claiming Rancy and or Fancy and Cozy Bear.
That said, whoever they were, they did actually, they started short denial of service attacks, usually around 30 minutes for some of their targets, just to prove that their demands are credible. So it was an actual like risk, even though these most likely were not the, you know, Russian state government backed GRU threat actors. Even though the stock exchange itself wasn't hacked, it was their website and some of their information sources, and I kind of like brought an idea like to my head where a lot of the economy in the United States is tied to the New York Stock Exchange, for example. And how concerned should we be about a cyber attack targeting it, maybe to cause even more dysfunction within this country?
I feel like a lot on the flip side, first, just so I can drop my personal opinion, I kind of think stock exchanges are silly and they're gambling and they're not actually doing it on a business's real success and viability. And it's more so
what are you saying? Tesla isn't the... where is Tesla right now? Like the fifth most valuable company in the world?
Yeah, Apple's number one. I'm not an Apple fanboy. But anyways, I just, the idea of this false inflation of companies' value based on not their actual profitability, but this legalized gambling seems crazy to me. That said, markets jumping up and down do cause people to open or close their pocketbook, which does directly affect the economy. So we should certainly be afraid of it, think of it as a possibility. And this is not, to be honest, this type of DDoS one is kind of the brute force least worrisome thing, because it's almost obvious. You could let everyone know it's a DDoS attack and the economy is not falling, and hopefully their speculation wouldn't affect markets much. It's ones where people do more nuanced attacks to short stocks or whatever. What was it? Finn, I forget the actor. It was an APT actor like Finn 15 or Finn 7, but there was a particular named threat actor who their specific attack was to go out and pick a few companies that they had some credentials for, short their stock before doing stuff, and then sending a lot of spoofed emails to key players at those companies from other people that were key players at other places, creating rumor that essentially caused the stock to go down over the long run. So it's definitely not that...
There were other examples too. Like back in 2010, there was a individual in Russia that through his trading company, he would buy stock in a company that didn't see a lot of trading volume and then use stolen brokerage accounts, like hacked brokerage accounts, to then buy a bunch of stock in that same company and artificially inflate the price and then sell their own shares. Sometimes even when the stock crashed back down, back that up with short selling as well.
Yeah,
they even made like $250,000 in just a few months of doing this.
And to me, those type of attacks have more real world financial implications and are a little scarier because they're kind of under the radar. Whether or not we even notice them happening really depends on whether they're caught. And you know, the ones you and I are talking about, I would be willing to bet they're not all the ones that have happened. And we just know about them because one threat research group or another happened to find them. By the way, it was Fin7, the one I was referring to. And I think they also called Fin7 the Carbonac group or something like that. So if you're curious about it, you can definitely look it up.
Now, what about like other risks? Like since stock exchanges are heavily reliant on data and quickly processing that data in order to gain an edge over other traders, like what if someone's able to inject fake data into the feeds? Like, for example, modify the sell and buy orders in whatever data feed someone's using, which will trick their algorithms to do something else.
That's obviously a concern, but I feel like of the markets out there, finance and the stock market is a little more up to speed compared to other industry verticals on security. So I assume for actual trades, there is a lot of cryptography going on, which would make it slightly harder and more let's not joke, not even slightly, quite a lot harder to do the type of interception and modification of some of these. Not that it's impossible, but I have a feeling it would be a much harder attack. But to your point, you know, anyone that's read all the crazy stuff that happens with the stock market, if you know how the internet's built, there's some certain backbone routers and basements in New York and other places. And you've even seen movies where people, to create a faster connection to to be close to the New York Stock Exchange, people have done crazy drilling and or cable laying projects. And the first one that can actually get cables laid through really crazy territory get like a millisecond faster trade times, which makes them billions of more dollars. So in a system where that type of timing exists, you could see how a more sophisticated DOS attack or some sort of timing-based attack where you're kind of just trying to not necessarily change a sell or a trade, but you're trying to kind of DOS the particular packets for one specific trade to let yours get through first. I'm certain there's a lot of potential there. I suspect it gets complex, and because it has to also do with simple proximity and who owns some of these lines and really are key backbone locations, it's probably not trivial to pull off, but I could see it being possible.
I mean, internet backbone routers are basically public knowledge. Like,
yeah,
you can identify based off of someone's IP address where they're hopping through.
Access to the equipment. Like, there's a few places in the world where we know are really kind of the key points into, for instance, the New York Stock Exchange. I don't think that data is unknown. I think being able to access it and to get your packets to be there faster, that's where the complexity might lie.
Fair. I wonder if, like, sometime in the future, though, we'll have, like, some big IPO coming up, like... I don't know. What was the last big IPO? WeWork that kind of crashed and burned. That didn't even happen, did it? But some big IPO with like a lot of hype, a lot of chances to make a lot of money really early on. Maybe you'll see some threat actor find the edge router closest to like their competitors and just blast that with traffic to take it offline. Like that could be a potential avenue for attack to interrupt stock trades.
Yeah, do IPOs
even
happen?
Maybe I should make a
movie
out of that. Die Hard 6.
I wish I could remember. It's a relatively recent movie, but I was fascinated. It was all about these like technical get things done nerds who were selling to some big investment that they could get this line built that would give him faster transactions, but involved like basically putting a line through all this crazy parts of America that it took a lot of work to get access to. I wish I remembered the movie.
Was this like a documentary?
No, it's a drama. It's actually a big name Hollywood movie that someone out there listening is probably smashing his hand into his hand saying, Corey, why can't you remember it? And I think it's relatively recent. I guess recent in context of COVID times isn't the same. I think I probably watched it on a plane, which I haven't done in a long time. But anyways,
if one of you happen to know exactly what it is, tweet it out to us at #the443podcast to save Corey from himself.
Well, it wasn't anything to do with cyber attacks. It really was a fascinating movie, though.
So either way, though, like as of right now, it looks like the New Zealand Stock Exchange is working with a local DDoS protection provider to try and increase their defenses. Each of the interruptions has only been for a few minutes, I believe, but still, like, I guess I don't know how big the New Zealand Stock Exchange is and the face of the world and how important it is, but you could imagine someone taking the same style of attack and applying it somewhere where it could cause more damages.
Yeah, I don't know either. I will say the one thing I'm disappointed on but the one thing we don't know here that I'm interested in is the technical details. Like you and I have talked a lot about the different types of DDoS attacks, whether botnets were involved, whether it was reflection, what surfaces were used for reflection. So I do hope eventually we get that sort of information. Maybe when we do, it'd be interesting enough to do an update. But for now, there's very little detail about the technical details of the attack itself that I can find anyways.
Yep. Maybe a story for another time. So moving on to our last topic. Just this last week, researchers at Proofpoint published a blog post detailing a new threat actor they've dubbed TA2719, I guess since it's their 2719th threat actor. And in their blog post,
crappy
they cover
naming.
Their methods for delivering remote access Trojans to their victims. Now, so far, the threat actors have only targeted victims in a handful of countries like the US, a few in Europe, and I think like Uruguay. And the hooks themselves from the phishing emails aren't really anything special. Like some of them impersonated local government, police. They had like urgency threats with messages like urgent message from the Royal Thai Police in their local language, or the last police invitation before the arrest. That one was in Russian, I believe. And some of them pretended to be shipping notifications, which is pretty common and run-of-the-mill. Others pretended to be from local Center for Disease Control, since COVID's a really big hook these days. So even though the phishing messages themselves weren't super interesting, what I did find interesting, though, was how they were distributing the Trojan. And it's something I don't know if we've talked about on the podcast yet, but it's a really interesting evasive technique now for email attachments. So each of these phishes included either an ISO file as an attachment or via a link to a compromised website that was hosting that file. So ISO files, they're disk images. They're basically copies of physical CDs or DVDs. And if you click on it or mount it, your computer mounts it like a directory. And then in this case, it will contain the Trojan, where if you click that, you execute it. And the reason that this is kind of gaining popularity is a lot of anti-malware engines don't actually scan ISO files. Good news is if you're a WatchGuard customer, APT Blocker does. But a lot of like traditional ones out there aren't going to pick up on the malware inside of this disk image, which can allow it to make it all the way to the endpoint and potentially execute.
I will say, by the way, it's probably not the first time we mention ISO files. I think we often tell people not to be careful with piracy, not just because we think it's bad to pirate someone's work, but because a lot of the time pirated files don't come for free, and it's a great place to inject other things with the software. So it's definitely not the first time we've seen malware or attacks embedded in ISO files. The email's a little interesting. I feel like I recall seeing something from a few years ago that never got big that was an email ISO file attachment. I also don't know, usually, one thing that is true for us, we definitely can scan ISO files, but we do in some services have file limitations. So when we've talked about ISO files in the piracy context, like if someone's downloading a pirated version of Windows, one, there's a good chance that it has a Trojan embedded. But two, those ISO files become, you know, at least 600 megabytes to, you know, multiple gigabytes. And I will say many antivirus vendors, including us, do have file size limitations.
Right. Like a security hardware only has so much RAM, so you can't mount a, you know, 1.5 gigabyte ISO just to scan it. It's just not possible.
On the flip side, I suspect for this email, when you're doing email-based malware, obviously your target file has to be small. So that's probably not an issue in this case. We could totally catch it. But in the past piracy cases, we have warned that those overly large files can also have malware attached. But you're right, I don't see it in email often. The other thing this makes me think of, by the way, is back in the day, back in, I think, 2014, 2015, when we're all talking about...
Yay, another Pop Corey story.
It was when ransomware was still early. I did some stuff on the evolution of ransomware. Because even though ransomware really only took off in 2013 with the crypto ransomware variety, it's been in existence for a long time. And it's also evolved from attacks that weren't ransomware. And the one I always think of is Fearware. There was a period of time in the early 2000s, maybe 2010s, that the type of thing you would get is an email claiming to be the FBI, showing your webcam and your IP address, and specifically saying that you've been caught doing something like piracy or something really gross and sexual, and warning that they were going to prosecute you unless you sent them money. Wouldn't criminals just love that they could get off for piracy if they sent the FBI $500? But anyways, that was called Fearware. In the other context of the story, the fact that it's actually pretending to come from these pretend authority organizations makes it similar to that Fearware. And the reason I brought up ransomware is that Fearware kind of evolved into, if you think about ransomware, it's a Fearware in a different way. It kind of evolved into ransomware too, from Fearware.
Yep. And at least demanding ransom payments, in this case, for real damages versus fake potential damages.
Yeah, for actually locking up your data versus pretending that they caught you being a criminal.
Yep. But either way, ISO files as a delivery mechanism are on the rise. So make sure that whatever security services you're using are able to scan them and look for malware inside them. I would honestly say, how many times have you legitimately emailed someone an ISO file?
I don't think ever.
That could potentially be a file type that you might want to block entirely through whatever proxy you have.
Even if arguably back in my younger person days, I might have encountered an ISO file or two besides the Linux installers. I don't think I've ever had a reason to email an ISO file.
Because like you said, the legitimate ones are going to be pretty large in size, at least for email standards. So if you get a smaller one, might as well just block them and deliver them through some other mechanism if you have to. But I guess it is what it is.
Yep, it is what it is. Everyone's dying.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics, suggestions for future episode topics, or if you know the name of that movie Corey was looking for, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at XORRO_. Corey is at SecAdept, and the both of us are at hashtag the 443 podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you'll hear from us next week.